Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. And what is it? Yes, it's the weekly podcast for people who play with needles. That's what it is.
Yay.
I'm not getting
so
over
that. I'm so happy about that.
Yeah, I'm not getting over
that.
That
makes me happy every time.
That's a good one. And our guest this week, we're very happy to have with us, Janet Perry, the needle point everything. Hi, Janet. Welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, now you just kind of have your fingers in everything needlepoint. So my first question for you is, would you describe yourself as an educator?
Yes, I think that's probably the best way to describe me. I educate people about needlepoint through my blog, through books, and through my email classes.
Yeah, and I first ran into you when I was collecting blogs and other things for the Feedly. I use Feedly for my news reader, and I have news about cycling because I'm a cyclist, and then I have news about all kinds of needlework, and that's where I first found you. Was it Needle Point News or Needle Work News? I forget now. You think I'd have
Needle Point News.
Yeah, Needle Point News. Cause that, you update that thing all the time. I mean, you're one of the great curators of Needle Point News that exists.
That's helpful.
I found it very frustrating myself that I couldn't find information because there isn't anything that collects, any place that collects needlepoint news, so I wouldn't know where there were classes or retreats or trunk shows or whatever, and I figured other people have this problem too, so I started that blog as kind of a sort of no-frills blog. The articles are very, very short. I do 3 of them a day. And they basically are always about news things.
Where does all that come from? Is it just years and years of collecting this so you have all these sources? Or are you constantly trolling the internet looking for things?
Actually, virtually everything I find that's on that blog comes from emails.
Oh.
So a lot of shops now have gone from printed newsletters to email newsletters. And whenever I can find a shop or a designer that does them, I subscribe.
Oh, so you've got an inbox just packed with stuff then.
Oh, gosh. But, you know, in my past, I edited a newsletter on internet standards for a computer company. And when it would be time for the internet standards guys to meet, I would literally get 150 emails a day.
Yeah.
So all I do is everything that comes in, I just tag it for the news blog. And then every morning I go in and I say, okay, what's the oldest stuff?
Okay.
And because they're color-coded, I can find them pretty easily.
Yeah.
So what kinds of things would you consider news? Like what types of items are appealing to you?
Classes, retreats, trunk shows, sales. I remind people when it's getting close to finishing deadlines for Christmas or summer's coming up and it's time for you to look at entering something in your county fair. I do things about exhibits. If a shop is moving, I put that in or if a shop has changed ownership and I find out about it, I put that there. If a designer's going and doing a meet and greet or a special event at a shop, I put that in. So basically anything that is news goes there.
Okay. Well, it's become one of my tools for keeping up with things. That's for sure, because it's so regular that a lot of these trunk shows and stuff all over the country, they don't mean anything to me, but it's just interesting to see what's going on, and you do put out a pretty steady feed of a lot of things, so it's pretty easy to, and it is nice. A lot of them I can just do a quick scan and move on. And
well, that was the idea, to make it very quick and easy for people to read.
Yeah. Well, that works. That works.
You know, and it's become so popular, I'm actually thinking about upping it to 4 times a day instead of 3 times a day, because I have such a backlog of stuff.
No.
That's insane. So how much, I imagine that's pretty time and labor intensive to do.
That one's not too bad, because I'm not adding a lot of my own content. Mm-hmm. What is time consuming is writing the main blog, which is nuts about needlepoint. You know, that I face the same things any other blog writer does. What I'm going to write about today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making it long enough.
And how often, the nuts about needlepoint, how often do you update that?
That gets updated every day, once. Monday through Thursday, it is an original column. And Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I find things through my reader, you know, through my news reader.
Yeah.
Or my blog reader, rather, that look interesting, and I post them. But it's never just, oh, well, here's a really great blank. I usually try to, if I can, add something about it. So this is why this is a useful thing, or this is what you'll learn, or this is an article about embroidery, but you can use these ideas in this way.
So Janet, one of the questions, anybody who curates as much news as you do, what kinds of trends are you seeing in the needlepoint world? I mean, obviously there's a lot of trunk shows and there's all that kind of stuff, but you must pick up some trends as you collect all this information of what people are looking for and what they're doing and what designers are doing. Are you seeing trends?
I am seeing trends. One trend I'm seeing a lot of is that there are many younger designers getting into the business now, which I think is a really great thing.
You know, yes.
It's needlepoint is not entirely these days made up of aging baby boomers.
Mm.
Because the last big...
You know, I resent that. Yeah, I resent that. Aging baby boomer. Now, that just...
Yeah, well, so do I. But, you know, what are we going to do? But, you know, needlepoint was so popular in the early 70s. And lots of us took it up then. But, you know, maybe we were in our teens or in our 20s or when we did that. And now we're grandparents. And it was perceived for a long time as an old lady kind of thing and not very hip. And now you're seeing younger and younger designers coming in. They're buying shops. They're designing painted canvases. They're bringing a really fresh, interesting perspective to needlepoint and doing stuff that will be encouraging to younger people to design. I used to go to a shop that I refer to as the place where good needlepoint went to die. Which just sounds awful. But I would see these canvases at trade shows and they would be bright and colorful, lots of fun. I'd say, gee, that would be really fun to stitch. And I'd go into the shop, and because of the lighting and the color of the carpet and the way they displayed their stuff, these exact same bright, colorful, fun canvases would look old and sort of fuddy-duddy.
Yeah.
And what you're seeing now is people are presenting needlepoint in a much brighter, fresher, edited kind of way that really highlights the good stuff that's out there. And is making it exciting for people who are younger and encouraging them to come in and try needlepoint.
What role do you think the internet is playing in bringing in the younger people?
I think needlepoint is kind of behind the curve in this. And I've sort of struggled with this problem for a long time. Knitters have places like Ravelry. So tons of people who don't have a real knitting shop nearby can get on Ravelry and they can find all the patterns they could ever want to knit in their entire lifetime. They can learn about books. They can take classes. They can do all sorts of cool things. Quilters have a lot of internet resources as well. But needlepointers, it's not so much. It's getting better, but it's not as good as it should be. There are some shops that have really great websites, present a lot of information, do online classes, have videos, and really are embracing the internet. But by and large, needlepointers seem a tiny bit afraid of it. I hate to put it that way. But there seems to be a sort of hesitation about really embracing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, I'm a member we're both members at Needlepoint Nation on Facebook, and there's two or three other groups that are Needlepoint, but that seems to be the most active group, Needlepoint Nation, and I enjoy that, and there's a good amount of activity there, but certainly nothing like Ravelry. Ravelry's that thing just scares me.
I know. I've gone on it a few times. It scares me, too. But, you know, where in the internet are people posting cool stitches? Where on the internet are people posting great free patterns? How many stores have their entire inventory online? I think I know of two. I know lots who have some of their inventory online, but I know maybe two or three that have their whole inventory online.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, you know, here I am in, you know, who knows where. And the closest shop is several hours away.
Right.
If I'm interested in needlepoint, how am I going to learn? You know, I can't go to, you know, blank big box craft store and buy needlepoint canvas and a good kit and nice threads and learn it. I've got to be dependent on the internet.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because just as an experiment I was in, I had to get some kind of paints or something. So I went into Michael's and AC Moore, which are sort of our local big box craft stores, and I took a peek through their needlework sections. And I remember as a kid, you'd be able to go in and get, you know, all the dimensions kits and all of those things. And the only thing there was no charts at all. There was the usual DMC threads there, you know, I don't know, maybe 50 colors or so. And then tiny little, maybe 4x4 pieces. I think they were dimension kits actually, just little, you know, sort of nothings that you would do in, you know, a couple of hours. And that was it. There was no other needlepoint at all. No tools, no stretcher bars. I think there might have been canvas a little bit. Certainly no linen, and that was it. There was nothing.
And these are places. If there was canvas, you were lucky.
Right, right. And these are places that have fair yarn sections, but the trick with that is that there's never any, or there's usually not very good quality yarn. So you can get all of the scratchy acrylic you want in all of the yucky colors, and you can find a fair amount of baby yarn and perhaps some cotton and four colors of self-striping sock yarn, and that's it. If you want anything a little nicer, you need to go to a specialty store.
I know exactly what you mean, because a few times in my life I have decided that I should not just do needlepoint. I should do something else to relax. Now, I have learned that this is very foolish because I'm not a person who can relax very well. And one of these times, I started knitting. And I still occasionally get this desire to knit because I'm a serious fiber fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love stitching with weird things. So I also stitch with knitting yarn. And so I will sometimes go to my friendly neighborhood Michaels in town and I will look at the knitting yarns and I know exactly what you mean. You know, the stuff you can't stitch with it. And I know I could knit with it if I knitted.
Right. You know, and it's funny because, you know, getting back into these crafts, I can see how, if I hadn't done it previously or if I wasn't driven by another, means or a method or reason, if you picked up acrylic, you know, yarn and started knitting with it, you would be turned off, I think, to the hobby altogether because it's not enjoyable. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't have a good hand. It doesn't behave well. And I can see why a lot of people would just do it and kind of throw it away. It's only when you'd make that extra step to go and get, you know, good quality, something that feels beautiful, that it becomes enjoyable.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what I found.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, think about scratchy acrylic sweaters you buy it for clothes. They're not
right.
Very nice. How could it be nice to knit with that stuff?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, and yeah. I was lucky enough when I moved to California. I did not know this when I moved to California. My husband's a native San Franciscan. And when I moved here, we were lucky enough to live half a block from a needlepoint store and about three blocks from an absolutely wonderful store that sold knitting yarns of various kinds on cones. So you bought it by the pound and they would buy very weird things. They also had classes in how to dye stuff.
Hmm.
And all sorts of wonderful, strange, strange threads. And it was like heaven to go in there. They had hand-dyed Persian wool. This was in 1981 when nobody did that. And they would have classes that would teach you how to do it yourself. And it was like having to just go there and kind of walk around and see what looked cool and buy it. But I realized that that store was completely unique.
Yeah, one of a kind. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You
know, now, Janet, you've been doing this for 40 plus years, according to what I read. 40 plus 47 years.
47 years.
Yeah, yes. So you're the classic, started when you were a kid, learned needlepoint, what, from your mother, or tell that story.
My mom's an artist, and my paternal grandmother was a crackerjack seamstress and knitter and crocheter. And once my grandmother had tried needlepoint, you know, one of those horrible, the middle section is already stitched for you, and all you have to do is do the background.
I never understood why you would buy something where the design is stitched and you're just going to basket weave the background. Just shoot me. I never got that.
Well, I agree. But, I mean, think about if you just want something relaxing to do that you don't have to think about when you watch TV. Now, of course, you know, she wasn't doing it watching TV, but, you know, she did not finish this piece, but she did know how to needlepoint. So my mother always had us trying different kinds of crafts and all the time when I was growing up. And so I was just starting high school. It was like my first month of high school, and I got a craft magazine. And had in it what I absolutely shudder to think of now. They were patch pockets that were needle pointed for your jeans out of Persian wool. It was a kit. Now, obviously, if you made them and actually put them on your jeans and then washed your jeans, something horrible would happen.
Yes.
But I thought they were so cool. So I showed them to my parents, and I said, can we please see if we can find them? I really want them for a birthday present. And it was coming up on my birthday, and they took me to the local needlepoint store, and amazingly enough, they actually had this kit. So we bought the kit and brought it home, and my grandmother was coming over. She taught me how to do a basic needlepoint stitch, and I just took off and didn't stop. I think within like 3 months, I had probably made a dozen of these pockets.
Each one ruined by the washing machine.
No, I never put them on my jeans.
Oh, okay.
This is the really weird thing. I just loved making them so much. I gave them to friends. A friend of my mother's had a craft sale. I sold them there. I'd use the colors that came in the kit. Then I'd go back to the needlepoint store and I would buy different colors of wool and make more. And by that spring, I was making my own designs with my mother's help and stitching bigger things like pillows.
Mm.
One of my high school friends even has something I stitched back. She still has something I stitched back then.
Wow.
Her name's Dorothy, and we called her Dot, and I made her a pillow with a giant red dot on it on a white background. And she still has it. Which is kind of scary because I don't have any of that stuff.
So when you look back at that stitching, was it pretty good? Are you still pretty pleased with it?
No, it was terrible.
Okay.
But you know, it definitely set up the pattern. So all through high school, needlepointed. I didn't know anyone else who did my own age. The ladies at the shop loved me because they did not have young people who came in. So I was like their little pet. Uh-huh. I went away to college and I needlepointed all the way through college. And I went to a very, very small college. One of our professor's wives owned a needle workshop with four of her friends. And we had formal lectures for everybody at the college on Friday nights. And so one day I was down at her shop, and her name was Dodo. D-O-D-O, like the bird.
So we have Dot and Dodo in your life, okay.
We have Dot and Dodo in our life. Dodo was a very, very proper, formal German lady with this totally strange name. And I went, and I said, Dodo, how come I never see you at lecture? And she said, because my quilting hoop will not fit between the rows in the auditorium. And I told my husband I would not come to lecture unless I could quilt during lecture. And I said, well, Dodo, I always need a point during lecture, and sometimes I quilt, but it's in my hand. She said, nope, I've got to use a frame, and if I can't fit my frame, I'm not coming.
Okay.
And I said, fine, you know, that's great. But, you know, so she encouraged me in stitching while I was in college when everybody else thought it was a little weird. And, you know, by that time, that was the mid-70s, and things like the needlepoint book were coming out and other kinds of stuff. And, you know, my mom being an artist, we would try things like we'd go, there was a weaver shop for a little while near my house, and we'd go and we would buy weird threads, and we'd buy dyes. We'd dye our own threads, and then I'd use the needlepoint book, and I'd try different stitches. And so I was always trying all these weird things. But up until the early 80s, when I discovered painted canvases, I always designed my own stuff.
Oh.
And then
What kind of things did you like to design? What sort of things did you like to stitch?
Oh, I loved to stitch and still love to stitch Bargello. Mm-hmm. I would stitch lots and lots of Bargello things. I would there were a fair number of books out then that were project books. And I would buy them and I would stitch projects from them. I stitched a lot of things from the book Needlepoint from Great American Quilts, which came out in the late 70s. I made a whole lot of those. Christmas ornaments, pillows. I'd find a cool stitch and I would make a pillow out of it. You know, I'd find an interesting thread and I would, you know, make a sampler from all the different colors of it I could find. I once went on a hunt all through San Francisco for weird threads to make a pillow for my husband's aunt. And I finally ended up at knitting shops because they were the only places that had strange and wonderful threads. You know, because back then everybody stitched with wool, and if they were really rich, they stitched with silk.
Yeah, see, I started in the 70s, and I only knew wool. And
I only knew wool, too.
And that was expensive enough as far as I was concerned. I couldn't even imagine silk.
I definitely agree. And my first experience with silk, because you asked me if there were any threads I hated. And back in, I guess it was like 81 or 82, I got off the bus and I saw this wonderful lion and unicorn backgammon board in the window of my local needlepoint shop. And I thought, oh, this is really wonderful. So I went and I bought it, and I decided I would stitch the lions in wool and the unicorns in silk. And wouldn't this be beautiful? Now, I had never stitched with silk before, but did that stop me? No. And I bought the silk that the store sold. And it was a Swiss silk that's no longer made that is legendary for knotting. It is like the worst silk on the face of the planet for people who have never used silk before. And, of course, it kept knotting. And I have, you know, however many unicorns there are to do. That did not work out well. I did not go very far because I hated this silk so much. And I swore I would never, ever, ever stitch with silk again because it was so bad.
Yeah.
So several years later, I'm at Needlepoint Incorporated in San Francisco, and I'm looking at this very pretty sunflower design. And the lady who owns it, who knew me as a regular customer, said, well, you should do this in silk. It'll be really beautiful. And I said, I'm never going to stitch with silk again. And I told her what had happened. She immediately knew what thread I had used. And she said, all silk is not like that. You'll really love stitching with silk. You've got to try it. And so she convinced me to stitch the petals of the sunflower in silk. And she was right. It was really wonderful because not all silk is as bad as that first one I tried. And as I got more confident in using different kinds of threads, I got better able to overcome bad threads. I still would never, if this thread came my way again, I would still never stitch with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think the problems could be overcome. But there are not a lot of those kinds of things out there.
Yeah. So how do you go through college? You stitch. How do you get to the point, you know, internet comes along, and how do you get to the point where you're doing what you do today, which is teaching, designing? I mean, everything you do is online, from what I can tell. Is that right?
That is right. Everything I do is online. Well, in my past life, I was an internet geek.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I worked for an internet company. And in the early 90s, I was heavily involved in extending the internet throughout the world. I worked for a networking company. I work with education institutions. So I've been on the internet since 1988. That's when I got my first email account. So the internet stuff is something I'm really used to. It doesn't seem weird to me. And then in the mid-90s, I got sick and I had to quit working. And because of being sick, I had to figure out something else to do. And being an internet person and writing websites wasn't exactly making me much money. So I decided, brilliant idea. I'd always wanted to have a needlepoint magazine. So, and there wasn't one at the time, and I said, oh, I'll publish a magazine. This'll be really great. And then I started to research what you need to do to publish a magazine.
Yeah.
That'll open your eyes.
Yeah. That's exactly what it did. Nobody in my town knew anything about how to do second-class mailing. So that left me with the post office regulations on their website, which were very confusing.
Yeah, those are written in original Greek. Yeah.
Yeah. Or Sanskrit, or something equally useful.
Right.
And then I started looking at new magazines that I was buying in other fields. And, you know, they get their first issue out. Wonderful deal. They'll suggest to you become a charter subscriber. You buy the charter subscription, and then they have printing problems because they're only getting started. And they miss issues. And I said, between the post office and them not knowing what they're doing and this printer thing, I am not going to publish a magazine because I can do the content, but I can't deal with this other stuff. So I'm sitting there and saying, oh, well, this is wonderful. How could I possibly do what I want to do without the problems? And about that time, this was in the middle part of 96, a company came around called the Mining Company. And if I tell you what their idea was, now this seems like a no-brainer. But in 96, this was startling. They were going to do content creation on the internet using a framework that they created that was standard. So basically in 1996, they were doing a blog with advertising.
Uh-huh.
And one of the areas where they wanted someone to be what they called guides, which were the people who were the content creators, was needlepoint. I swear, it's probably because the guy who started the company had a mother who needlepointed.
Of all the topics, yeah. That's one of them?
That was one of them. They had needlepoint, they had knitting, they had quilting. I think they had crochet, they had a couple of other crafts. But needlepoint's just not something you expect to be there. So I applied and I became their needlepoint guide. And this was perfect.
Primarily because you're the only one.
Well, yeah,
probably. I was the only one stupid enough to do it. But they did all those things I didn't want to do. They created the framework. They made sure it stayed up and running. All I needed to do was write. And I said, this is wonderful. This is the best thing ever. So I started doing that. And basically at the mining company, which then became about.com, and now the crafts things have yet a different name, which I can't remember. It's like Homestead or something. I did that from September of 96 till September of 2001 when I finally quit. And I developed stitch guides and I developed content. I created samplers and I had free designs and I created lists of websites and website reviews and book reviews, thread reviews, and all this kind of stuff. And in 2001, I left them because it seemed to me that their direction was different from my direction. they really didn't want us at that point to create a lot of content. They wanted something more like what I'm doing with the news blog, short, punchy articles with tons of links.
Okay.
And not much education. I said, no, I want to be an educator. So I quit and I sent out my newsletter independently for a couple of years. Then I discovered this blog stuff and put it all there. And that's where I've been ever since.
So you were one of the original bloggers for all intents and purposes then.
Yeah. You know, now I look at what they were doing and it does not seem particularly revolutionary, but right. Back then it was really revolutionary.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like some store saying, oh, well, we've had a website with internet commerce since 1995. You know, in 95, people didn't have websites.
Right. Right. Yeah. So then now you've built up, I mean, you've got multifaceted website because you have your Napa Needlepoint and Nuts About Needlepoint and then Needlepoint News. And what differentiates those three? Why three? And how does that all break down for you?
Well, Nuts About Needlepoint is the basic blog, and so it's got reviews, it's got reference information, it has free designs, it has announcements about my classes. Napa Needlepoint, once I get it back up and running, is my e-commerce site. Needlepoint News is just news, strictly news, nothing else. And they're very short articles that almost always have, you know, the prototypical call to action. Go to this designer site to see the designs from this trunk show. Call this shop to register for the class. Go to this website to register for the class.
But the real meat is the blog.
The real meat is the blog. And pretty much everything else has spun off from it. I didn't want to do sales per se on the blog, except when I announce stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Napa Needlepoint, I changed essentially into an e-commerce site to be the place for that.
Okay.
Then I have a couple of specialized websites, one about stitch guides, one about needlepoint plaids, that are kind of, there's this whole trend in blogging called microblogs, where basically what you do is you create a tiny blog or a blog-based website that is about a particular small niche of a subject. And instead of updating it, you just create it and forget it. And that's what Needlepoint Plaids, for example, is designed to do. It has the information there, but it doesn't get added to very much.
Okay, well, let's stop right there, because in my research of all the things you were doing, I saw that Needlepoint Plaids, but I ran out of time. I couldn't get to it. Needlepoint Plaids just makes me think of Scottish kilts. So what goes on there?
Well, basically, plaids are real interesting because if you thought about a plaid, or if you were a weaver and wove plaids, you would realize that a plaid is just stripes that go in two directions and intersect. So you can create a plaid out of all sorts of different things. Tartans are one particular kind of plaid, but you could use a name or a birth date or a street address or a random bunch of notes in a piece of music and make a plaid out of them. As long as you have a sequence in either direction and you do one sequence for the vertical lines and a sequence for the horizontal lines, you will create a plaid.
Hmm.
So plaids are actually amazingly easy to stitch. They're kind of like Bargello, except it's all 10 stitch.
Okay.
You do the stripes in one direction, and as long as you know the sequence of colors and how wide each stripe is, you can do that. And then you go and you do the stripes in the other direction. And once again, as long as you know how wide the stripes are and the sequence of colors, you can stitch plaid. So I wanted to create a site because I have one of the things I do is I will do custom plaids and tartans for people. So if you want a plaid for a birthday for someone, for a new baby present, you could tell me the name and the birth date and what colors you want, and I will chart a plaid for you.
Hmm. That is interesting.
They're really fun to do. You could do one as a wedding present. You know, the wedding date and the initials of the bride and the groom for the two different directions. You could do, I've done ones with, for, I also will chart tartan. So you give me your last name and I look it up on, there's an index of all registered tartans that's in Scotland. And you can go and you can put in a name and it will show you all the tartans for that name. And I can use those to generate a needlepoint chart from that. So you could get a needlepoint version of your clan's tartan.
Now that's fun. That's fun.
So yeah.
It's really cool because you can make something easily that's very, very personal. And so I did a chart, custom chart for somebody who wanted a royal stored Christmas tree topper on a star. I did a lady wanted a belt for her husband that had as the background his clan's tartan.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we took a little 21 stitch section of the plaid that would look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So that it would be, you know, not like green with a little bit of red down at the bottom and the top. Something that would look interesting. And then she was going to put his initials all along. So you can use these things because they're very easy once you've figured it out. They're very easy to stitch. So needlepoint plaids was designed to say, this is how you stitch a plaid. This is what plaids are. This is what a birthday plaid is. This is what a tartan is. And if you want any of these, here's a form to fill out to tell me what you want.
That's neat. It sounds to me like it's mindless escape stitching where you really don't, once you get the thing together, you don't have to think about it. You just sit there and just move the needle and thread.
Yes, it is. It can be very mindless. And in fact, for a while they may still be made. There was a company that made kits of plaids called Tartan Point. And what they did was, it was even more mindless. The way that I do it, you have to remember what the sequence is and how wide the stripes are. These guys, they actually painted outside the border of the pillow that you were going to make, they painted the stripes in both directions. So you actually did not even have to think as much. You could do this as mindless needlepoint and come up with this wonderful, you know, 10 or 12 inch plaid pillow.
It's mindless, and we're even going to take mindless out of it.
Yeah. You know, tartans are kind of like Bargello. They're one of those things that you can stitch without having to think about it a whole lot once you figure out what you're doing. You know, right. How in Bargello you just make the first line, as long as you remember what order the colors are, once that first line is in, you just fill up the space.
Right. Yep. Now you didn't do a magazine, but you've done a boatload of books, and you seem, do you continue to publish books, regular printed books and ebooks, right?
Both ebooks and printed books. I have two of my ebooks I've redone as printed books, and they should be coming out in the next week or so. It's very discouraging to me, the commercial publishing and the needlework book world. I mean, I won't just say needlepoint. It's all needlework books and commercial publishing. If you don't sell a whole bunch really, really fast, within 6 months, they're remaindered. And within a year, you will not be able to find them anymore. So I knew that I had some content I wanted to turn into a book. Because I had collected, when I was at about.com, I collected hundreds of tips. And I said, you know, this would make a really nice book. And it would be good if it was out in the world, but I don't want to wait a year and a half for a commercial publisher. I don't want it remaindered in 6 months. I want it to stay out there. And by that time, print on demand, which is like the best thing in the world for writers, came out, and I said, oh, I could find someone who will print a small run and I can sell this book. So originally I found printers that would do small runs of, you know, like 300, 500 books. So I did not have a garage full of books.
Yeah, that's one of the problems of book publishing. Somebody's got to store them somewhere.
Yes. And, you know, this way I could create a book and it could stay published. And I didn't have to be beholden to the agenda of a commercial publisher, which necessarily is different from my agenda. So the first few times with the first two books, I did it that way. I found publishers who would print small runs. Then I, after two of them went out of business on me, I said, this is may not be the best way to do this. And I found a real print on-demand publisher who basically, I create the books there and they print them. And if I have sales for books myself, I can order books and have them sent to customers, whether they're shops or distributors or individuals. I can order books to have here at home to send to people. And they're listed on Amazon, and they have their real-life books with, you know, real ISBN, so stores can order them if they want. And I don't have books in my garage. And I don't have to save every box that comes from Amazon for anything else so I can ship out more books.
Yeah, fulfillment is not something you want to be in if you're a book writer. You want to write books, not pack boxes and books in boxes and mail them out.
Well, you know, at one point, I think we had basically the underneath part of a 4x8 table full of boxes waiting for me to sell books to ship them out in, because I never knew how big a box I was going to need. So I saved them all.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I saved, I had bags, garbage bags full of Polish popcorn, or, you know, packing peanuts.
Right.
That I would use to fill up the remaining space in the box.
Yeah, shipping is, a lot of bulk and unless you're moving stuff quickly, yeah, it can suck up a lot of space, no doubt. So when you
and
do
a lot of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, you have to go to the post office even, and, oh, the post office sometimes likes me to mail, sometimes they don't. So sometimes you can print out the postage on your stamps.com account, but other times they decide they don't like that. And so you have to go into the post office. I mean, it's this is so much easier. The hardest thing is proofreading, which is not my best thing, and you do it over and over and over again.
Right. Yeah.
But, boy, it's pretty painless, and so these are my 14th and 15th book that are the two I'm working on right now.
Mm.
And I have one other that is nearing completion. It's being proofread now, and I have to still do the cover for it. And then I have like four more that I should be working on, but I'm not, because I want to get these ones done.
Yes. Now you
there are a lot of.
You also have ebooks, and is an ebook basically a PDF?
Yes.
Okay.
I do them as PDFs. There are people who create Kindle books. There are people who create books using Apple's interface, which is called iBooks. But I'm one of those least common denominator sort of people. I figured the easier you make it for folks and the more widely available, the better. So all my ebooks are PDFs. I write them in Word and then create the PDF afterwards, so that you buy the book, you know, through Napa and Needlepoint, or your shop orders it from me, and I send them the PDF, and then they give you the PDF, or they print it out, and you've got it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's how I do my stitch guides, too, because I don't know if you use the same word processor as I do.
Right.
Or I don't know if your computer's really old. But if I do a PDF, you're going to be able to read it. You're going to be able to see the pictures and see what I want you to see.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay, and then the last aspect, and we're going to run out of time here. The last aspect of what you have is classes. And for your recommendations, you wanted to talk about a couple classes you have. Tell us about how you do your online classes. And then tell us about those two classes that you have that are underway now or coming up.
Coming up.
Okay.
I do all my classes as emails so that the lessons are sent out. You register for the class, and I make an email group. And I send out the lessons as blind copies and attachments. Some of my classes, the lessons are actually the emails, but they're only two where I do that. Most of the time, the lessons are sent as PDFs. Now, some of my classes are notebook classes. Some of them are project classes. Some of them are more, I would say, knowledge classes. There's not a project with them. But I try to keep them affordable and easy for people to use. So I don't do video lessons because you may not have a computer that can get video very well. Or you may have a flaky internet that doesn't stay up. Or you may look at the internet on your phone.
Right.
PDFs everybody should be able to look at. JPEGs as pictures everybody will be able to look at. I don't do classes that are Facebook groups because I don't like to be beholden to another person's idea of privacy and what I can and can't do. In the past, most of my classes had a Yahoo group, but I have become very ambivalent about doing that now because it's become so hard to use. And the last time I had a Yahoo group for a class, I spent more time solving Yahoo problems for other people than I did join the class. So basically, I'm trying to do technology that's easy to use that you're not going to have to worry about.
Right. So what's a notebook class? The other ones I get. What's a notebook class? What do I do in that?
Okay. Actually, one of the classes that's coming up is a notebook class on Bargello. And the idea behind that is that it used to be when books were expensive, if you wanted a reference for stitches, you made a sampler. And the sampler would have little sections or lines of all the different stitches. What a notebook class does is, instead of having you make a sampler, you have a notebook, and you print it out, you print out the pages, you three-hole punch them, you put them in a binder. And for each stitch, there's a little area where you can tape in with double-sided tape a little sample that you stitched of the stitch.
That's nice.
It's really nice because it's hard. You kind of sort of know what the stitch looks like from the diagram, but you don't know really how it's going to look until you stitch it yourself. So creating this kind of notebook gives you a chance to try. You use your scraps of fabric, of canvas, and your scraps of thread. But maybe you want to try some different threads. It gives you kind of a non-stress way to do that because you make your little 1-inch sample or 2-inch sample and paste it into the notebook. And then you can make your notes and say, God, I really hated this stitcher. Wouldn't this be wonderful for background? Or I'm going to use this here. So you're creating a permanent record for yourself of stitches or threads or, you know, techniques. So that's what the notebook classes are, and I call them 25 stitches because that seems like a good amount to do in a 3-month class.
Okay, so what the one of them coming up is a notebook class, and that is about
it's
stitches?
It's a notebook class. It's 25 Bargello patterns.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to be a 4-month class instead of a 3-month with 4 lessons. The first 2 lessons will be the 25 Bargello patterns. But then it occurred to me there are so many fun things you can do with Bargello that don't really fit in that 25 patterns category. You know, how do you create a birthday Bargello? You know, how do you create something I have done in the past called op art Bargello? How do you divide up a pattern into quadrants? So that picture I sent you is the quadrant one, so that it looks good. So the third lesson is going to be about stuff like that.
Okay.
And then the fourth lesson, which is what I've done the last 3 years in the class, the last lesson for each of these 25 stitches classes has a sampler in it. And so that will use a number of the stitches that you've already learned put together in an integrated design. Most of them have been based on quilt blocks. This one I think is going to be really interesting because I found a quilt block that's like a cityscape kind of thing. So I'm going to do
nice.
It like a city. And I think it could be really, really neat.
Yeah.
I've been kind of saving that block for something special.
And you found it. So okay, we're running out of time here. What's the other class now?
The other class is my annual session of Create Your Own Stitch Guide. And I've done this one once a year for several years. And the idea is that you don't have to spend a lot of money having someone create a stitch guide for you. You can do it yourself. So this class is 10 weeks long, goes through and starts out, how do you understand yourself as a stitcher? And how do you understand canvases in relationship to you as a stitcher? So you pick a canvas that you can do. And then we talk about threads, stitches, and picking stitches, and backgrounds, and go through and answer questions, and we go through the whole thing so that by the end of the 10 weeks, you've got a lot of information that, you know, in theory, so you should be able to create your own stitch guide for a canvas.
Yeah.
Based on that. And as part of that, I pick canvases from people in the class and say, okay, well, I'm going to give you a stitch guide for this. So you get example stitch guides. And I show you my successful canvases and some canvases that are total disasters. And the ones that are disastrous, I talk about why they're disastrous and, you know, what I should have done instead so that, you know, people don't think that I'm always perfect because many times I'm not. So they get to see good things and good examples and bad examples so that they can go through and say, okay, well, this is what I am. I'm a very cautious stitcher. I don't like to go very far out of my comfort zone. I'm a very adventurous stitcher. I'm willing to try anything.
Yep.
It took me a really long time to learn this about myself. And, you know, one of my problems is I'm extremely adventurous when it comes to thread, but I'm very cautious when it comes to other parts of needlepoint. And I have many canvases I never finished because they were too hard for me or they were too adventurous in the wrong way.
Yeah.
So this has been very popular because I think it helps stitchers get an insight into themselves, but also an insight into how to do their needlepoint themselves.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like fun. So we need to wrap up here, Janet. And, of course, as always, on the page for this podcast will be links to all of Janet's sites, and you can go there to get her classes and sign up with her blog and other things. And, boy, Janet, thanks a lot. Been a lot of fun chatting with you.
Well, yeah. You are welcome.
Yes.
I really enjoyed this.
Yeah,
and I've been enjoying the series a whole lot.
Oh, thank you.
It's a really great idea.
Well, thanks. Yeah, we're enjoying doing it. That's for sure. Yep.
Well, good. Well, you guys have a great evening.
Okay.
Thank you, Jen.
And with that, we'll end this Fiber Talk show. And as always, you can get all of them through your favorite podcast app or go to our website, wetalkfiber.com. And, of course, links for all those shows are on that site, and thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week.
Take care.